Hey, folks, this is Rafat Ali, CEO and founder of Skift, and I am on the Smack podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, before we get started, let me quickly introduce you to today's sponsor, because first of all, it's a cool one. And second of all, we need to pay the bills. So today's episode is brought to you by Winnow, the leader in food waste management solutions. And if you haven't heard about Winnow, first of all, catch up. And second of all, their AI tools help kitchens around the world cut waste and save serious money. In fact, shout out to all those chefs and hotels out there that are using Winnow's AI magic already today, because you legends are saving more than $100 million every year in food waste. So well done to you. Keep on rocking, making the industry greener and better. And now let's start with today's episode. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Smack Hospitality Podcast. And this episode features Rafat Ali, the founder and CEO of Skift, one of the leading travel media companies on the planet. Rafat and I caught up to talk about all things related to travel and tourism in the US, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, how his personal story of starting in journalism led him to founding Skift, and his recent conversation with the new mayor-elect of New York, Zohran Mamdani. Enjoy the show. Thank you for being on Smack. Thank you for taking the time. I realize with being in the travel world, you travel probably as much as many people can possibly even hardly imagine. So I appreciate you taking the time for an hour all the way from New York. I'm going to start with a very easy one, and I think I don't think you need too much introduction. But those that don't know about Rafat, obviously Skift is what really put him on the map in the travel world. Now probably considered by most one of the leading platforms in terms of news knowledge exchange, and I'll let you share some of the details of what you guys are getting up to at Skift in a second. I'm going to start with a very easy one, if I may. If you look at this past year of 2025, and what's kind of happened in the bigger travel space, without focusing any of the details yet, has this year lived up to your expectations in relation to the travel industry? Has it exceeded the expectations in some fronts? Give me your end of year recap.
Yeah, well, thank you first for having me. I'm excited to be here. We just met in Abu Dhabi, right?
It was correct.
Abu Dhabi. We've traveled so much over the last few months, weeks. So 2025, I mean, I think we can't divorce travel from what's happening in the world.
Right.
And so 2020, how much can we swear on this podcast?
Go right ahead. Go right ahead, man. Whatever the fuck comes to your mind.
It's been such a mind fuck this year. It really has been in so many ways. Obviously, news and, you know, world happenings wise, it has had an effect on travel. Yeah. It's been such an uncertain year. Travel has still mostly pulled through.
Yeah.
As in, you would have imagined this would have been a much worse year than you would have, you know, with all the uncertainty. I think it's interesting that I think travelers, those who at least who can afford to travel, have figured out their way around uncertainty and are still traveling. You know, one part of the world is having issues, they go to another part of the world. Europe continues to be really, really strong where you're sitting right now.
Yeah.
In terms of inbound into Europe. Outbound from Europe is an issue, but that's a bigger discussion. So I think net, I'm surprised that travel is as strong as, you know, maybe January, February would have thought that things would have looked a lot worse as we're sitting here now.
Yeah.
Ending the year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my general sense. And obviously that's just a general state of travel. The tech part has the discussions and the experiments and the realities have changed a lot in the last year, particularly around AI. And so I think 2026 will be a fascinating year.
Yeah. If we, and we'll touch on all of this in a second, Rafa, before we do that, I would briefly love to talk about you, which I feel is something when you Google, I'm not sure how often you Google yourself, but if I obviously did prior to this conversation, and I asked our employees of the month, Claude and ChatGPT as well, what is there to know about the man?
That's a nice term, yeah.
I don't know how often you do this, but there's actually not a whole lot of information out there about you. There's a lot of conversations out there that you've had with senior executives. So I really, aside of this gift and travel conversation that inevitably wanted to have, I'm going to try and get something out of you as well, if you let me. And I wanted to ask, probably very few people know this about you, but your background, if you don't mind me saying so, technically has absolutely nothing to do with travel. If my research is correct.
Nothing to do with travel. Yeah, correct. Yeah. Nothing to do with travel. I'm a journalist.
You're a journalist by heart, right?
Well, I'm a computer engineer by
study. Yes.
Yeah. My undergrad degree turned journalist degree, turned media entrepreneur. So it's sort of those are the phases that I've gone through. And travel, I guess my existence as a British-born Indian-American, having traveled a bunch, having lived in a bunch of places, would put me in a good position to to start Skift, which is what I've said this before. Everything I've done in my life prior to Skift got me ready to start Skift.
Yeah,
and so which I think is true for a lot of people, but as in whatever businesses they start. And so for me, it's been just such an incredible 13 years now, and the biggest. I think the most satisfying thing for me, just intellectually being in travel, is how seamlessly global it is. I mean, you and I, as I said, we just met in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
And now I'm in New York, you're in Berlin, and we'll meet in India for all I know.
Yeah.
And so just the seamlessness of how we move through the world. We're privileged enough, obviously.
Sure.
To seamlessly move through the world. And which is just the most fascinating part about running Skift and being in the business of travel.
Yeah. If you look back at the journey, Marfan, I'm sure there's a couple, and we've established that we can swear on Smack, so I'll keep that tradition going. I'm sure there's a couple of what the fuck moments there that some you'll be comfortable sharing, some not, and that's totally fair. Give me one or two moments in the journey of and maybe even your own personal journey with Skift, where you said that perhaps really is either what put us on the map or it was a defining moment for us. When you started Skift and when I first heard about Skift was back in the very early days of it when I was still studying hospitality. So I was already in more or less the field. But you guys, were fresh coming out of the US, kind of setting your, and if we look at it now, it's, there's events, there's lots and lots of reports that you publish, you do events around the globe. There's obviously that there's a news element to it, and yada, yada, yada. And we'll get into that. But give me one or two moments on that journey where you thought, God damn, it's happening.
Yeah. I mean, very early, one of the first stories that put us on the map was that we broke the Priceline, back then was called Priceline, not Booking Holdings.
Yeah, yeah.
bought Kayak. And for Kayak had just gone public and was quickly bought by them for like $1 billion, I forget exactly the number. And it just so happened that we broke that story and it broke our site, as in our site was down because we got so much traffic for it. And we're early, it was just me, Jason, and Dennis. And because Dennis Schall, who's our executive editor, employee number one, knew online travel so well, I broke the story. He and I and Jason all did some follow-ups, stories and like implications for this small world that we care about, which is online travel.
Yeah.
And so that people say, who's Skift? And why are they breaking this news? And so that's a small part of it. The second was, I would say 2014 with Skift Global Forum.
Yeah.
And Skift Global Forum, which has now become our iconic New York based conference, which is a version of it. You were there in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the first year was 2014 in New York at the Time Center, which is a venue here. And I still remember the capacity of the venue. It's 378 seats in the venue, like 13 years later, I still remember the capacity because we sold out like a month before the conference. And that said, oh, wow, we're on to something. I mean, it was sold out as in people were buying sponsorships just to get in because we had sold out of tickets. And it was a huge success. It was a one-day conference. We had an opening event. And for the small company our size, we were 10 people then. We're about almost 100 people now. So that definitely put us on the map. And then other parts along the way that I would say, like in COVID, we went through the same pains that everybody else went through in travel. And we had to make cuts. I had to lay off one third of my team. But we tried not to cut editorial team as much because we said this is the story of our lifetime. And if we do good coverage in this very uncertain times, then the industry will remember us for having been there when the industry needed us most in terms of this, you know, trying to understand the uncertainty. And we did. And we just did great coverage, our team, editorial team, just editorial research, the whole company rallied around. And so certainly that would be one. And then I do feel like actually this year, 2025, I feel has been a year of our rising influence. Mm-hmm. And for me, sort of impact and influence is what matters. Like how much are we how much do people make decisions based on or not make or change their decisions, whatever, based on our output.
Right.
Or being influenced by our output. And I feel like this year has been a great year where I could, and I've been traveling a lot this year too, more than previous years.
Okay.
And so, you know, when you're in the market, you can actually see and tangibly feel some of this impact. So I would say this year has been 2025 has been pretty seminal for us. I say this, I probably have said this every year, but it just, our business continues to grow. I mean, look, media, which is what we are, media information company, in the best of times is hard. And, you know, these days, as you know, media is tough. But
very tough. Yeah.
Yeah, we've carved our own way by being focused on a sector, by sort of super serving that sector in 10 different ways. And, you know, we've been profitable. We've been solidly profitable since COVID times.
Wow.
We were sort of break-even-ish prior to that. And, you know, it's up to us to lose now.
Yeah.
If we do. So that's, I think, the... that's how I'm thinking 2025 as we're ending the year.
And walk me through this, Rafat. If you look at kind of your journey, your personal journey and Skift's journey hand in hand, how's it changed? I imagine especially for somebody like you who's got a journalism background and let alone the travel element, I imagine, you know, we could probably both agree that journalism and media, as you said, has changed in general, perhaps even more drastically than in the travel world, because there's, you know, there's very different influences. Again, mm-hmm. you just touched on it, right? And in the Middle East, there's a certain buzz going on. In Asia Pacific, there's some challenges, but some optimism. Europe is very dependent on whether we talk about inbound or outbound, as you touched on already, right? So there's a whole lot going on. The US is a story of itself. We are going to need to speak about your new mayor in a second. Just a brief sentence on that from you as well. So, but my point is this: there's a whole lot going on, and a company like yours, which is already, you know, got the image of being fairly modern, fairly forward thinking, and so on and so forth. Every little piece that happens, you guys need to be there and jump right on it. I imagine that does put some pressure on you guys on the team. So how has it changed being in the media space? From back when you looked at it in 2012 with Jason and until now, there must have been huge changes and COVID obviously being one of them.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was personally my own journey. When we were three people in a room, it was all of us hustling, doing everything.
Yeah.
I got many years later in the depths of COVID when we had to cut the team and it was existential. I got a flavor of it again, as in we are hustling back and forth, all of us in a room, metaphorically speaking, because we're obviously in our houses. That reminded me, I talked about this to Jason, as it like feels like we're back in our early days because it was so existential as a business. Since then, particularly over the last 2-3 years, I have, my role has changed a lot. I have a chief of staff, I have an assistant, which has allowed me a lot of leeway to think about things that the company at this stage needs, which is growth, future growth, continue to think about operational excellence. One of the things that I'm thinking through in 2026 is we've sort of underinvested in technology operation systems over the last few years. And we need to, so we've started, I would say the last few months have been early work. The last couple of months particularly have been early work in all to come in 2026 in terms of investing in operations, people, and systems, if you will, tech. And so all of that is ongoing, which is fascinating, the fact that we have the luxury now and our roles have changed. Jason and I role have changed from day to day to this. And, you know, at the end of the day, the role of a founder is to make themselves useless. You know, that's the goal, ultimately, as in the company survives and thrives beyond the founder. So sort of I'm on that journey.
Yeah.
Not leaving anytime soon. I'm hugely enjoying it. But, you know, if you have that mindset, then you build systems and operations that sort of independently run. And then you're focused on the things that matter, which is how do I bring new growth? How do I continue to attract top level talent? How do I continue to have a culture that people are attracted to and thrive in amidst so much uncertainty? And obviously now the added layer of like, how do I use AI to supercharge myself and as well as our team? And what does that mean? And that's part of what I said, which is operational excellence. How can AI today not be part of it? And obviously going ahead. So, and then, you know, different parts of the business run by themselves. I don't have to worry about them every morning when I wake up. You know, certainly that part has changed, thankfully. And so, yeah, tons of stuff has changed. The fact that we're so much more, as I mentioned, travel is seamlessly global, but our business is also very global. Mm. Means our team is also very global. So we have people in 16 countries.
Yeah, well.
Mm. Which pre-COVID, we were in New York and a few people West Coast and a few people in London. That was it.
Mm.
And now we are US, UK, and India happen to be our major hubs. US still the large part of our employees, but they're not New York centric anymore.
Mm.
And again, COVID reset our business. All the cliches that a lot of other people went through, we went through as well.
Yeah.
It's just that we never went back to office, which is, you know, the a lot of companies have, the larger companies have. We have no intentions of, and obviously pros and cons to being in an office, not being in an office. But net for us as a business, having a fully remote, distributed, whatever term you want to use, has worked out for us. And that is, you know, that means we have to put a lot more effort into making sure people feel connected.
Right.
To each other. In a virtual company, it's hard, right? Especially as the company grows beyond a certain size. So we, you know, the company usually meets twice a year, the full company.
Right.
Different teams meet in different parts of the world, like at the conference you were at in Abu Dhabi. Yeah. There are about, you know, maybe 20, 25 people that met. So imagine six of these around the year. So a good part of the company gets to meet each other multiple times a year.
Yeah.
And that you'd be surprised how much that compensates for us not being physically together daily.
Mm. It's very interesting, that story, because I had asked around, obviously, and I knew a little bit that was the structure that you had. How and without wanting to get in the political discussion of what, you know, how much home office is good and how much home office is bad, because I'm really not keyed on that conversation. But do you reckon that the decision to not go back to the office after COVID was perhaps a little bit ahead of time, even looking at what the trends are now? I saw recently that Spotify, for example, has decided to stay fully remote as well across most of its offices. And there's just a general bigger acceptance of the remote work now on both sides of the spectrum, partners, clients, but also staff that, you know, prefer that extra bit of freedom. So was that decision maybe even ahead of time, right after COVID?
Well, I mean, at that time it was forced on us, which was COVID. And then we had to save money at that time, so it was a no brainer. Otherwise, I'd have to lay off even more people than we did. And so, from that perspective, and then as a business, we've become so much more global. Middle East, where you and I met recently, has become such a big part of our business. And so, India has become a good part. You know, is becoming a part of our audience. Business is going to follow. Southeast Asia. Obviously, Europe has always been, in addition to US and then other parts of the world as well. So it's just the seamless global nature of travel is very much reflected in the seamless global nature of our business. So it made sense for 16 different countries. India, US, UK, and India are hubs for our employees.
Yeah.
But then we have employees in other countries as well, like, you know, one or two employees in Panama, Philippines, et cetera, different parts of the world. Continue to grow that, South Africa. It's also one less thing to worry about. Like, it's so hard to run a business, and employees have so much cognitive load and 20 different things. It's just the whole, what in US is called RTO, return to office. We don't have to, like, it's like, I'm bald. I don't have to ever think about shampoo. And so it's just one less thing in my life to worry about. I don't need that. I mean, you know, whatever, it's not expensive, but point is, it's not, I don't have to worry about it. And back to office, I don't have to worry about it. Like, it's just off. We figure out how to be best at what we do, which is the work and collaboration and connection versus the physicality of it. And as I mentioned, we do attempt to meet multiple times a year, full company as well as different teams. And also because of the concentration of people in, I would say, New York area, London, UK, and then India, people do meet the local people that are living, like here in New York, we meet once a month or once every other month at a co-working space. So again, these are the things that we've deliberately done to help build connections. We have other cultural things that we do internally that help foster that connection. We have a buddy system for anybody who joins, or even people who've been here a long time that are not on each other's teams, as in they don't work together on a daily basis, such that there's a better connection to the rest of the company. Every Monday we have a full company-wide call in which, besides everybody, you know, different teams telling what they're doing, we have a section around sort of generally, like, yesterday this happened, because today happens to be Tuesday as we're recording this. Yesterday, one of our event team employees talked about a retreat that he did that was very meaningful. He did it 10 years ago, but it was so meaningful to his life that he still has a lot of impact on his life and how he's lived his life since then. So sort of like, you know, a little bit of peek into the personal side, we try and do for all of our employees around the world. For me, the biggest thing that I try and tell our employees, us being based in the US and started as a US company, and now that we're global, how do we not be US-centric? Because as you know, US has a very easy time falling into the trap of being sort of US-focused. So my goal has been, and I think we've done a decent job, but you have to keep reminding that if we're talking about American football, chances are nobody else understands American football insider references in the team. Thanksgiving, which is coming up, I don't know when this will be released, but Thanksgiving, which is coming up, is not a thing in the rest of the world east of US. So, and the rest of the team is working, actually, Thursday, Friday, while we're not working. So, yeah.
Rafael, seeing as what you just said about the US and the US centric, I'd love to touch with someone like you who's been, you know, around the world, and as you said, you traveled quite a bit this year. I'd love to touch with you on your perspective of the different regions that we have going on and travel space, and kind of hear your feedback about it. And we'll go west to east. So we'll start with your home turf. We'll start with the US. I realize we could fill probably 3 podcast episodes per region, but we're going to try to make it work in 2025 minutes. So let's start with the US. There's huge conversation going on about the US this year, as you know as well as I do. As many flights to Europe this summer from the US as there has ever been in the history of US commercial air travel. A lot of Americans, looking to get out of the country, especially in the holiday periods. Not that much of an interest to travel to the US from traditionally strong markets like Europe, even Asia, which tend to be a little bit more resilient. Give me your thoughts on the, and I realize this is a topic that's close to your heart because it's home turf for you, but give me your thoughts on the US without, you know, dwelling too much into politics, but obviously it plays a role to some extent. How worried are you, Rafa? Straight up question, how worried are you?
Yeah, it's a tough spot. I mean, look, it's been such an uncertain year, as we talked about at the start of the podcast, and a lot of it driven by US.
Right.
The world is uncertain because of US. And so that is, don't forget, we have another 3 years to go with this.
With what's happening.
It's a lot of time left. Expect fireworks, continue. And so I think inbound into US will be tough over the next few years. Yeah. It's been tough this year. We'll see what happens with the World Cup. I think World Cup will be, this is World Cup football.
Yeah.
Should be fine. As in, we all worry about these big events like Olympics and stuff and leading up to it. And then turns out when the game actually starts, everybody forgets everything.
Yeah.
And it just focuses on the magic of whatever sports it is. Hopefully that will happen because, you know, this is the biggest World Cup in history. As in, like, I think the teams have gone up.
Amount of teams or something like that.
The amount of teams have gone up, and it's 3 different countries that are hosting it. And so logistically challenging, but if we can't pull it off, then, you know, who
should?
Yeah. Who should? So I think from that perspective, I'm excited about some of these big events that are happening in US and US at the center of it. So hopefully that will help. But other than that, it's going to be tough up and down. Europe is not that keen on traveling to US, as you said. Canada, obviously, other parts of, the Chinese travelers haven't come back in the way, at least not in the West. Just not enough flights. To begin with, India, which was a big rising star for US, the Indo-US relations have also soured in the last few months, which you would not have expected. Students, Indians became the largest foreign student population in US over the last few years post-COVID. But that also is also in trouble now with all the stuff happening back and forth. So just a lot of uncertainty in US. One of the reasons why Americans are traveling abroad is just, and you mentioned we're going to talk about Mamdani. The brilliance of what he has hit upon, which is
affordability. For those that don't know, sorry to interrupt. For those that don't know, the new mayor of New York.
New mayor-elect of New York, Zoran Mamdani. I mean, it'd be hard for you to not have heard of him right now.
It's true to the media.
Amongst the most famous people in the world. Forget like US, it's among the most famous people in the world. It's incredible. Yeah. As you know, we were in Middle East and the people coming up to me and like congratulating me. I said, like, why congratulate? Because, you're Zoran one. There's so much spotlight on him and he's inspired so many people around the world in many different ways.
You spoke to him, Rafa, right?
From Abu Dhabi for the conference we were at. So we managed to get a short interview with him on his tourism agenda for New York City.
Very cool.
So this was a week before the actual election date. So I was quite impressed by what he talked about. He also said he wants to increase the tourism budget for New York City, which was the first time. And I'm sure the tourism folks have been very happy to hear that wants to increase the tourism budget for New York City. So affordability crisis is real. I mean, it's not only US, Europe, UK, Europe, everywhere has become more expensive. And it's, you know, people are being priced out of housing and cities, et cetera, et cetera. And so, so I think that's a real thing. And the reason why Americans are traveling to Europe is it's still cheaper.
Italy, Greece, whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 100%.
Then even though it is expensive from what it was previously, particularly pre-COVID, you know, New York itself and, you know, Disney or any of the big iconic cities or anything. New York, I joke, but it's incredible. Like, you go to coffee shops and people, they're like $7-$8 coffees and people are paying for it. Because it's, and in Queens where I live, not even Manhattan. And so it's just incredibly expensive now. And so I just think that that will continue to be a big part of general debate, but also that then reflects in travel. The since you understand the luxury travel part very well, you know, when CEOs on the earnings calls or conferences like ours, et cetera, say, oh, luxury is resilient, which is great, but it's also then a tale of two cities, as in the middle class, which drove sort of modern tourism over the last, whatever, few hundred years, are being priced out in many different ways. And if everybody just indexes to high net worth travelers, then we're losing a lot in the world and in the travel industry itself. So I feel like that is a debate that industry hasn't had and should have. And again, it can't be divorced from, it's not as if industry itself can alone solve this issue, but it's a fascinating thing. So that's US.
Yeah. Humor me with one more sentence on the US, Rafat. I was in the US earlier, just before your conference. I was in Vegas for the IMAX event.
And Vegas is just ground zero for just the extraction.
It's incredible. That I wanted your opinion on this because I was blown away. I've been going to Vegas for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now religiously for that one event. So that's my 1 week of the year or whatever it is, 3 days.
Oh, this is the IMAX you said you were there?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's always around the same time. It's always usually in around October or something like that. You know it. Right. You know the event as well right. as I do. And then I spoke to some people afterwards. One of them actually... I spoke to in relation to this very topic was a gentleman that I met and thankfully met through you. It was a guy called Jim Murren. Those of you that don't know Jim Murren, he was at the Skift Forum East in Abu Dhabi, and he runs the, amongst other things, he runs the yacht collection for Ritz-Carlton. And he's obviously, you know, his home turf, so to say, is Vegas. He's got strong connections, yada yada. And I asked him as well, and his answer was, look, there's nobody really has a good answer as to what's going to happen with Vegas at the moment, because it's incredible. Would you agree that the uncertainty, there is some cities like Vegas, for example, with traditionally have been, you know, hot spots for travel, whether that's conferences, sports, whatever it may be, that we simply don't know how that's all going to pan out. Would you agree?
You know, killed the golden goose, or whatever the cliched phrase you want to use, because they just resort fees and fees for this and fees for that just became like they kept on doing it. Meanwhile, competition has emerged in many different parts of the world.
Yeah,
and for, you know, the sort of casino type business. And obviously online coming into that picture as well, online gambling. And so with the US challenges, Canadians aren't coming to Vegas. Some of the lower end of the market has been priced out. Some of the luxury stuff is still doing fine. So yeah, it really is, to their credit, they've bet on sort of live sports entertainment, et cetera, F1, Sphere, obviously. Bunch of other stuff that's there, and so I think they've the new stadium, Allegiant, etc. So they have done good stuff, but again, it became too extractive. It's a great case study on sort of how not to do things, and it remains to be seen what happens there. I think there has to be a bigger reset, which I don't know if it'll happen on a private level, as in company to company level. So it's just people will stop going, and people are, you know, say, you know, voting with their wallet. So I think that's, and then alternatives, as we talked about, have emerged in many different parts of the world, and you know, even Middle East, where you would not have thought the wind is coming up in Ras Al Khaimah in UAE. You know, things are opening up in other different parts of the world as well.
Yeah, let's move east a little bit from the US. Let's talk about Europe for a second. And I know you gave your brief thoughts on this as well. I think the big differentiation we need to make in Europe is inbound and outbound, right? I think there's clearly two different sides there. I think give me your thoughts from someone who lives in the US, strong ties to India. You've got a bunch of people
Europe
that you have.
As well, yeah.
Set in the UK, obviously, as well. What are your thoughts on Europe? Because if you ask Europeans in the travel space at the moment, I can tell you most of them will say, it's not great. It's not terrible either, because you know, there's quite a bit of inbound that's still coming. Again, there's some that are missing, like, you know, the Chinese, which we've talked about, are not back to the extent yet, and so on and so forth. But what have you heard from your talks in the industry and the people? Potential, you know, opportunities. Yeah. Is it more?
The US
more
downspot? Remains very, very important for Europe.
Right.
I think the highest spenders will continue to be US. There's a fascination in different parts of Europe for historical reasons. The ties are strong, no matter what the political environment will tell you. And if this Russia-Ukraine thing gets solved in whatever way it gets solved, at least it gets solved. To the extent that it can be, that will help in terms of stabilization of Europe. I mean, Europe is going through many challenges, including sort of demographic changes, as in population getting older, many different countries and regions getting hollowed out. Immigration certainly part of it as well, and so a lot of, but you know, there's still iconic cities, regions, countries that continue, like Italy continues to do great, parts of France continue to do great, Spain continue to do great. The biggest part of European travel was intra-Europe travel, as in travel within Europe from one country to other. That's been hurt both because of the sort of just the economic weakness of economies within Europe and people's ability to spend, and then, as you said, Chinese travelers haven't come back, etc. So, and then, you know, environmental regulations now becoming a bigger part of sort of how people think long term about Europe. So I think net, I think as a destination, it's still the most powerful continent in terms of destination in the world. It's a matter of how do you bring new excitement into Europe and not just ride on your history.
Right.
That's a tough one.
And it's,
That's a tough one. Like, can you build new, like, it's not like Dubai, like you build five new things.
Mm.
But where are you going to build it?
Yeah.
Certainly not in the cities.
Yeah.
So I think it has some newness has to come, and I don't know what that is today.
Mm.
Sure, they'll host sports tournaments and music and stuff, and that will be new things that people get. But I think that's what something has to figure out, as in like what new can we do? And then, you know, the flight connections need to be strong. European airlines themselves need to be strong, which is not given, as you know.
Yes.
Obviously being taken over, you know, by being replaced by Middle East and India, and obviously American US airlines still very strong in Europe. So I think all of those will determine the future of Europe.
Mm. Before we go further east, let's talk about the south of the continent that's south of Europe for a second, Africa. It was partially a conversation that I that I've overheard now this year a lot is that there's quite a little bit of enthusiasm running around Africa at the moment. Some companies, depending on what business you're in, hotels quite optimistic, airlines not so much because it's still very difficult to get a proper airlift into Africa. And right. there's conversations there that are happening and need to happen. What's your kind of general top line take on it in a continent that's clearly still there's a lot you can do, right? There's a lot of pioneering. There's a lot of true pioneering you can do. It's not as saturated as Europe or certainly the US or even the Middle East at this point.
Yeah, 54 countries are
right. It's huge as well. There's tons happening.
I mean, it's obviously different ecosystems within it. There's the North Africa, which really means, at least in terms of mass tourism, Morocco and Egypt. Egypt and Morocco, Tunisia to some extent. Then obviously on the other end is South Africa, which is quite strong. And then the safari tourism, if you will, Botswana, Namibia, etc. Then in this end, Kenya, Tanzania on the eastern side. So there are different ecosystems that Rwanda up there as well now increasingly. And so different ecosystem, Nigeria, just in terms of economies, there's a middle class emerging.
Yeah.
And so they will want to travel out of the continent. And so that will become a bigger and bigger factor in the, say, next 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, we're sitting here in 2025. By 2050, the population will reflect that. The world's population will reflect that. Some numbers that kind of blew my mind a year ago or 2 years ago when I first read it is like one in four young people in the world and by 2050 will be African. And one in three people in the world will be African. Yeah. Just in terms of, because it's the one continent where population growth rate is still high compared to other parts of the world.
Yeah.
Assuming economic development catches up, that's a big assumption, but let's run with that. Then a big part of the world that you and I sit in will be dependent, increasingly dependent on African travelers.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the Western world ready for it? Not today.
I don't think so. Yeah, I agree.
But they will have to be. If Africans become that big a part of the world population, they're affecting everything in terms of culture, food, music, entertainment, like just the cultural part, and then the societal part. And so, So that'll be very fascinating to watch over the next. In terms of inbound into Africa, as I said, pockets are there, lots of development, hotel investment happening. You're correct about the airlift and the opening of the skies and capacity, et cetera, that need to come in. There's a bunch of low-cost innovation happening, low-cost airline stuff happening within the continent. And so that will continue to happen. And then they're leapfrogging tech cycles, as in mobile pay is the majority of the payment, for instance, in Kenya.
Which
in US is still not like
same in Europe.
So it's fascinating. It's sort of it'll be contradictions built in many different ways into the growth of Africa over the next at least two decades.
Tell me, and it's I fully agree with you. I think very few people know that. I think last time I checked, there's about 1.5 billion people that live in Africa. I don't think there's a whole lot of people that are aware of the fact that the continent is not just big in size, but also big in population. So I think there's a lot coming there. In the interest
young,
of time,
obviously the young
and, people and the young, being, yes, to your point, young, yeah. to your point, right? They want to see the world. Most of them have not seen as much of the world as some of the more spoiled, with all due respect.
But they're
more
exposed spoiled. To it through social media, etc.
100%.
So, yeah, definitely aspirationally, this is where Europe will benefit continue. To because just the aspirational part of Europe and hopefully US will still be there, I don't know, in 20 years from now.
Yeah. Let's go a little bit further east, and I think this is a conversation that I know is close to your heart, not only because it's a country that you have roots in, but obviously there's a big buzz floating around about the East, as everyone's calling it at the moment, led by India, facilitated by the Middle East, and I would love your thoughts on it, and we'll start with India because I think And I feel like you're the best person to ask this. Despite all the buzz around India, and you know, I think most people have now picked up on the population, the willingness of you know, the country's leadership to do something about tourism opportunities, yada yada yada. I think sometimes, and maybe you'll disagree with me on this, sometimes India is still a little bit under the radar for the fact that everybody's now picked up on the massive opportunities inbound and outbound of the country. Still, it's not. I don't know. It just doesn't feel like it's on the map as much as, do you know what I mean?
Well, no, it's no. You are correct. I was thinking about this. You know, we talk a lot about soft power in tourism, right? As in Turkish soaps or Korean soaps or etc. The rise of Korean culture overall around the world has led to an interest in Korea, and tourism has risen as a result of it. Turkey, the same thing.
Yeah.
They're exceptions. The rise of India's soft power in the world has definitely been there. Bollywood, food particularly, culture, etc. Big in US even in Europe, you know, Indians are running some of the top tech companies in the world So soft power has risen. That is not translated into tourism into India. So it's sort of a contrary example of, sure, soft power has risen in many different ways outside of India, has not translated to people going to India. Many reasons, including safety, perceptions, but also reality. You know, the chaos of India is only, you know, is completely real and is only going up in many different ways. So, definitely that's a huge part of it. I think probably one of the biggest parts of it is just the safety and the reality of safety in India.
Okay.
As a country for Western tourists, women, you know, et cetera, going into it. The outbound India is, as you know, a big story, great story, but we've already talked about challenges in US, but notwithstanding, but it's only a small, but in terms of percentage of population, that's still only a small part. So a lot more to come as people move into middle class. The biggest story, I think, has been post-COVID has been domestic, as in the renaissance of domestic tourism to the extent that it sort of reset the whole country's travel industry. And that in many ways, yes, people are not traveling into India, and they would spend higher dollars, obviously, than a domestic traveler would be able to spend. But companies have adjusted around it.
Okay.
And so, you know, anywhere from hotel companies to obviously airlines, which is the fastest growing aviation market in the world, is India. And so, you know, the two big Indian airlines, IndiGo and Air India, have huge planes on order, for international flight, but really for the domestic growth and the number of airports and the new airports and the airport development that's happened in India is incredible scale. So certainly that part will continue to be, and I think that will hold. So, and then, you know, I think that Indian travelers have basically made Dubai, Abu Dhabi, etc. I mean, they're the base of what UAE's rise has been.
Sure.
Saudi hopes that's the case. Even though a lot of the Saudi public effort has been around Western tourists. But the reality is the mass of it will come from Asian travelers, if you will, Middle East being, you know, is still part of Asia. So technically Asian travelers all around. I think Europe will follow a little bit later, but Asian and African travelers are the ones that will make the bulk of Middle East travelers for the long time to come.
Yeah.
And so I think the South Asia, Middle East corridor, which I find fascinating, will continue to grow. And then Africa will be added, obviously travel there, but will continue to become a bigger part of that corridor of sort of Middle East, South Asia, Africa corridor. Mm-hmm. I think will be the most powerful corridor in 25 years from now.
Which which leads me to a region where we met for the first time in person, which is obviously the Middle East. And I know, I think we both were at an event recently that was called Tourise. That was very shortly after your event in Abu Dhabi.
Both of us just came back.
Yeah, exactly. And Tourise obviously took place in Riyadh. There's a big conversation going around Saudi for some time now with, Vision 2030, and now the shift from public to private investment, where I know you've been vocal about it as well on your own LinkedIn. By the way, a great LinkedIn page to follow, ladies and gentlemen, if I can recommend, is go and follow Rafat on LinkedIn, because there's some great insights there. I'd love to hear in a short, and I realize we're slowly but surely running out of time, but I'd love to hear a couple of thoughts from you. I think the UAE, Rafat, firmly on the map. I think we can all get on board with that. Some very interesting developments there coming as well. And to your point, 5 years from now, we both probably would have bet against a casino ever opening in the Middle East anytime soon. And here we are, win on the horizon. I'm not sure if it's 27 or 28 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it's coming. That's the point. You know, Saudi obviously got, there's a World Cup on the horizon. And there's been some, things that haven't worked out the way that Saudi had planned them, and enough has been said about them. But I would love to hear your opinion on it. I think the same way with UAE, we can probably agree that it's firmly on the map. I think Saudi will materialize in one way or another. The question is when and at what speed, and fueled by whom. There's certainly some uncertainty there, but eventually it will happen. So what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I wrote about this after Tourise in a sort of a newsletter on Skift. I think that those of us who work with Saudi, it's incumbent upon us to give them a little bit of dose of reality, which is rosy projections and inflated numbers harm the development of the ecosystem for their own good. The obsession with Western tourists ignores the reality that this, what we just talked about, the majority of the tourists will come. The focus on luxury or sort of the flashy projects distracts from better ways in which tourism could be built. That said, they started from, I'm using hand gestures if we do this audio only, like it started from the bottom. They aim for, beyond the moon to Milky, outside the Milky Way. And they're going to land somewhere in the middle, plus minus. Yeah. It's still a huge, huge achievement to turn around a whole country from what it was. It's a large population, young people especially. I think the thing that has struck me the most traveling to Saudi last few years, my family lives there, my sister lives there, my cousins live there. I've been going for the first time I was there in 99. Just how hopeful and energy filled, if you will, the young people are, with all the changes happening, and very global, and the opening of the society, both sort of visible and invisible underneath, is real. And it starts with, you land at any of the airports, Jeddah or Riyadh, that like the majority of the immigration people sitting there will be women. And I would humbly say women are just so much more smarter than men. Like it comes across pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And highly educated, highly ambitious, very sort of in touch with the rest of the happening in the world. And this is the internet age. Everybody sort of gets exposed to everything. So, which is incredible to see. Like that's the great part. And I hope they lean into that. And focus on sort of unearthing the creative energy of the youth and the local entrepreneurs and everything else that comes with it, versus being so focused on exporting global brands and global talent. That's my one constructive criticism of Saudis, like bet on your own people.
Yeah.
Bet on your own culture, energy, excitement, and support them as much as possible, entrepreneurs, startups, and doesn't have to be tech startups, could be just their own local businesses. Hmm. And I'm talking travel industry particularly. But you know, the changes are incredible to see. You can see yourself, and the flights to Saudi are always full. Then there's, you know, the giant captive thing that they have with religious tourism is not going to go away, you know, for centuries to come.
Yeah, it's a good backbone to start for sure.
And the big backbone to start, and making that much better experience and sort of moving from there, I think is where the biggest opportunity lies for the country. So I think in general they will, as you said, they will end up in a good place. It's just going to be quite messy to get there, which is true for any, you know, any place.
Yeah.
And I think Dubai is fine. There was a worry I think Dubai had with Saudi's rise that Dubai would be in trouble. Not really. It's an orbit of its own. Abu Dhabi is incredibly long side, has long-term horizons and looking, you know, has done such a brilliant job over the last few years, particularly. And what's to come? They got Disney, they got Sphere, they got Harry Potter. Like, there's tons of stuff coming.
Yeah.
So their future is made too. And the rest of UAE, I think Qatar, speaking of Middle East, really had no follow-up strategy post-World Cup when the whole world spotlight was on it, and they did a great job organizing it, but had no follow-up strategy. And it's tough, as in like tiny country, like what assets do they have to attract mass tourism, for instance?
Yeah.
They don't.
Yeah. Not much.
Just like it's not structurally possible.
Yeah.
So there's that part, unless they build like a Dubai type thing. And Doha to some extent, but not really. And then Jordan and which always gets caught in the middle and everything, unfortunately, but a great product in terms of people going. So yeah, it's fascinating. And obviously it's the reason why you and I will keep flying to
we'll see each other there. Huh?
Many times a year for many years to come.
Yeah, I figured as much. Rafat, just like that, 45 minutes have passed on the podcast, and I'm fully conscious that you have other places to be on this fine Tuesday morning where you are. I'm going to say two things. First of all, a big fat thank you for sharing some of your thoughts and some of your stories with us. Secondly, on behalf of an entire industry, thank you for what you're doing, because it's well cool. I will say that. We haven't really touched on that. The team, but it takes, take it from somebody who runs his own company. It does take somebody to run ahead, and you've clearly done that, and you've built something that's truly been cool to follow. If you haven't been to a Skift event, then I strongly suggest you do it. The East one was my first one, I will admit. It will not be my last, so I will make sure of that. I have one little game to play before you run away, Rafat, and it's a fun one, so I hope we can have a little bit of joy with this. It's called Book by Bulldoze. So I'm going to give you three options of something, of a tourism or a tourism-centered kind of topic. And you get to book one, you get to buy the other, and you get to bulldoze the third one. And now this, for the sake of the game, obviously this is not in any way representative of your opinion or anything, but for the sake of the game, those are the three options that we kind of have. What we've picked out for you is not actually like physical destinations or airlines or something like that, or sports teams or whatever it may be. We've actually picked out kind of travel trends for you to say. And I'd love for you to kind of translate book and buy into something you feel strongly about, not so strongly about, and bulldoze you think is total crap. Okay.
Yeah. What's the difference between book and buy?
So book and buy, let's say buy is your number one choice, book is your number two choice, and bulldoze is your number three choice. Okay.
That's easy. Okay.
There we go. All right. Here are your three options. Wellness and longevity retreats. Number one.
Okay.
Two, AI travel assistance.
Okay.
And number three is virtual conferences.
Oh, that's an easy one. The last one is an easy one. And you knew it when you asked me.
Go on.
The third one has been proven wrong. And I was wrong on it as well. I thought virtual conferences would become a much bigger part of the ecosystem.
Than they have.
than they have. It may still with whatever those glass type stuff and just the physical, you know, what was it called? The Apple glass thing. I'm forgetting the name of it. Yeah, well, it's like nobody even remembers the name of it.
Which is not a good sign.
And I would say wellness and longevity retreats. And the second one was what? One was AI system. I would say this may not, I think that wellness longevity has something to it. I would actually buy that.
Okay.
And I would put AI assistance second.
Okay.
Only because I think for now in travel, a lot of AI stuff is gimmicky.
Mm.
And the agentic stuff, the promise of agentic stuff is real.
Yeah.
I just don't think the systems are aligned for another 3 to 5 years. I could be totally wrong. We're sitting here next year and you and I are booking through an AI agent and it's perfect. I just think human habits will take a while. I think technology will catch up, but the human habits will take longer to catch up.
And I know this is a topic that is very dear to your heart because I know that you had somebody from Anthropic as well at the Skift Forum.
We cover daily, like, how can we not?
Yeah. But it'll be interesting to see how it develops because I do agree with you. I think there is still some time to really make sure it works for what the travel space needs. I don't think we're quite there yet in some capacities. I think in the evolution of travel that the speed by which things sometimes develop, it might be 3 years. It might be, like you said, next year we have the same conversation at the very same spot and we were both totally wrong and it's, we're booking flights.
Which is the great part. I'm happy to be totally wrong.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. Rafa, thank you so much for this. It's been a breath of fresh air. All the best for the Skift team in 2026, and we'll see you around.
Thank you for asking me to do it.
That's it for this episode, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to share your thoughts on this episode and everything else that is going on at Smack with us by checking out our website at smack.media or connect with us on LinkedIn, YouTube, or Instagram. We'll see you next time.